philosopher, ethicalist, government advisor and academic, Baroness Warnock. Next up, one-man orchestra, composer, musician and singer, World Party's Carl Wallinger. Only two guest pebbles left in the velveteen baglet now. I draw out failed soldier, trouncingly successful novelist, mender of musical instruments and flautist of quality, Louis de Bernier. And our bonus guest this week, not the first time he's come up, the Franklin Engelman of fluid dynamics, the Egon Schiele of amateur Satanism, the Betty Marsden of consequentialism, John, for heaven's sake, Sessions. That's today's draw. If your wireless set matches at least five of these, then you have won 45 minutes of listening. You are a Saturday Night Fry winner. And as the sound of the mighty Wurlitzer of Roy Wooten and Bob Barrett playing An English Country Garden fades away like a wisp of unacceptably foul gas, I bid you welcome to Saturday Night Fry. You know, someone said a thing to me only the other yesterday that gave me pause. "You're so English, Stephen," they said to me. This is the thing I often hear. As it happens, I'm less than one half English. More than 50% of my being is as foreign as goulash, as alien as an avocado. Why is it that we think that someone like myself, whose voice seems to be made of stupidly old-fashioned tweed, whose bearing accidentally reeks of briar pipes, Horlicks, and the headmaster's study, and who loves cricket, is more English than a Brummy welder who drinks lager and finds cricket a dead ball? Am I a patriot stroke patriot? I love England, I love Britain, but some things in this country make me howl and weep. E.M. Forster said that if it came to a choice between betraying his country or betraying his friend, he hoped he had the guts to betray his country. One of the reasons I love my country so much is because it has produced people like E.M. Forster. It is a sweet and beautiful thing to die for your country. Wilfred Owen nailed that old lie. One of the great things about our country is that it has produced people like Wilfred Owen. But one wouldn't want to disown Rupert Brooke either. Bless him, or Kipling, or Newbolt, or W.E. Johns come to that, or the million village Miltons far from the madding crowd's ignoble strife. The best Britons are those who say, come on, this isn't good enough. We can be better than this. The old ways were fine ways, no doubt, but let's say no to slavery, no to child labour, to ignorance, poverty and disease. These days, a patriotic Englishman is more likely to look to Faraday or Newton or Shakespeare or Florence Nightingale than to Cecil Rhodes or Clive of India. The backs of our currency notes play safe. But how is it that I sometimes have to endure a Scotsman or an Irishman telling me how crummy, emotionally constipated and dead is the culture and character of England, when the slightest word of criticism of their home countries from me would bring down charges of jingoism, blimpism, nationalism, right-wingism, cultural imperialism, and any other nastyism you can think of? Our past supremacy still forces modesty and tact on the part of the English, while privileging nationalism on the part of the Celts. Nationalism, it's a nasty word. The last refuge of the wicked, perhaps. A Lithuanian struggling for national identity under Stalin is allowed to be nationalist. An Englishman or an American is not. Simultaneously, we devolve into fragments and convolve into global blocks. The systole and diastole of national identity confuses. The big capital letter words are cast aside. Honour is rebranded into social responsibility. The word duty provokes the horse's laugh. Let me sprint around the table, if I may, and ask our guestlets whether they regard themselves as above citizenship and patriotic duty, or whether their hearts and or heads can thrill to the notion of nation. Johnny Sessions, if I can start with you, does your heart quicken to Jerusalem, for example?
It does, as long as I can abstract that song and that poem from the context in which it usually resides. And when I see all those stupid Union Jacks, it makes me feel ill. It makes me think of Horatio Bottomley raising money in the First World War. But the actual poem and the song, splendid.
Mm. Julian, what would you say to that?
Well, I'd say it was my school song, and we used to sing it once a year when the Lord Mayor of London came to give us our prizes, those of us who'd won them. And so at the time, I loathed it, and I found I hadn't sung it for 40 years. And at a friend's 60th birthday party the other week, she's Australian, and she commanded us all to sing Jerusalem, and we all had our song sheets. And everyone knew the words, didn't need the song sheets. And it was profoundly moving.
Yes. Ah, well, that's a good answer. Louis de Bernier, what about you? What's your sense of nation, would you say?
Well, I love that song. It's one that I like to sing in the car with whichever passenger I have. It's a fabulous driving song. But it doesn't make me feel nationalistic in the slightest. What I want is the right to be patriotic about several countries without being nationalistic about any of them.
Good. Thank you. Mary Warnock.
Well, I actually detest that particular song. I can be made to feel patriotic by singing Rule Britannia or something, because I think it's musically marvellous, Rule Britannia. But I did sing Jerusalem an awful lot at my school, and the Arrows of Desire bit always struck me as intensely funny when I saw these people with their heaving bosoms under their fawn-coloured blouses, and it was really just a joke. So I can never really raise any feeling about England in relation to that song.
Right. Now, of course, the music was written by a Welshman, wasn't it? And I believe, young Carl Wallinger, that you are Welsh.
You're on the spot there.
Does it stir your bosom, animate you in any way?
Yeah, I mean, it does. It's just like, I suppose, all that stuff. I was in the chapel on a Sunday or whatever and listening to the rousing sounds of the organ and everything, but it sort of gets you. But, you know, it's just like, it's. I think of it like a sort of home, and I've left home sort of thing. And it's in the past, all that sort of stuff. I can still get moved by it, but I want a future that's not really got those connotations. Really.
Perhaps you're going to rebrand. Who knows? Now, the Work in Progress chair is very honoured this week. It's housing the pert and twinkling form of a good and great man indeed. Julian Patrick Barnes, author of Metroland, Flaubert's Parrot, Staring at the Sun, Talking It Over, History of the World in 10½ chapters, Cross Channel, and other lustrous ornaments of our literature. His prose never fails, not one sentence that isn't perfectly at the service of this master of his art. He has written of love, of death, of art, and of American soap operas, with exquisite discernment and wit. I called him earlier other novelist, for he writes two under the nom de plume Dan Kavanagh, crime novels which feature the delicious Duffy, as ambi as an oyster and twice as tasty. Julian, welcome to the Work in Progress chair.
Thank you.
I understand the novel under your own name is about to be launched, but first, are there any plans for more Duffy from the pen of Dan Kavanagh?
No, Dan Kavanagh, it's more sort of work in regress. He's sort of slipped backwards over the years. He last published at least 10 years ago, but he's a deeply embittered guy.
Right.
He thought that writing thrillers would make him successful, and he I can't occasionally run into him in a sort of, you know, back alley, I was going to say passage, or through a house, and he snarls at me. I see I'm much more successful than he is, and he just can't handle it.
I see. Well, I wonder
so
if
he's given up.
He's not your brother-in-law, though. I mean, it's not
accidental. I send him funds from time to time.
Now, you do have other work in progress under, as I said, your real name, a novel, I believe, which fits rather neatly into our main theme this evening, which is called England, England.
It is indeed.
And I've started reading it, and I'm ashamed to say I haven't yet finished, but I'm having a whale of a time. And I wondered if you'd just like to sketch out some of its plot, that which you don't wish to give away, you may reserve under your belt.
It's a two-part plot. It's a personal, emotional life, which runs through, treated realistically, which runs through the central section of the novel, which is a semi-farcical, semi-satirical, semi-realistic description of a vast project undertaken by a transnational entrepreneur on the Isle of Wight. And the idea is to build the ultimate upmarket vacationist's destination. That's to say, a replica of England, a replica of all that people coming to England would like to see. And obviously it has to be on an island, so he decides that the island, which he could probably vandalize with least outcry from UNESCO, is the Isle of Wight. And I can hear Louis de Bernier puffing on my right, because he has happy memories of this island, which I'm afraid I've covered with concrete, knocked down all the houses, and rebuilt lots of tourist hotels on in my novel. And so everything from, you know, Buckingham House to Buckingham Palace, that's one, to Lady Di's grave, to Stonehenge, are all created in replica on this island. When I started writing the book, I thought, well, of course, this is a bit fanciful, so it will seem futuristic.
Yeah.
And ever since, I keep coming up with examples of people doing just this. I picked up a copy of that wonderful quarterly publication, The Art Newspaper, the other day. And there is a plan to build on 1,000 acres of Italian countryside outside Orvieto what they call Roma Vetus, old Rome in perfect reproduction, with the Colosseum, the Forum, the baths. They're going to have bread and circuses. They're going to throw Christians to lions and vice versa. And it's backed by, you know, high-powered international businessmen, Saudi princes and so on. And then, of course, people won't need to go to Rome anymore. And in any case, Rome's all sort of fallen down, isn't it? And those buildings aren't what they used to be.
Mm.
And it makes sense. And when people do tests on the novel is partly about our preference for the replica over the original, and what value authenticity has. And that's the way in which the personal side of the novel connects with the public side of the novel. When people are actually asked to choose between the convenient replica and the inconvenient original, they will choose the convenient replica. They replaced Michelangelo's David in the middle of Florence a few years ago.
Saves you having to queue at the
Everyone goes to see it, and they don't need to go and see the original. Thank you very much.
Yes. And did you think or imagine that in some way patriotism is a dead letter? A useless quality or emotion or whatever one describes it to be.
Do I feel patriotic? I feel patriotic when I go abroad and England or Britain are attacked. Mm. At home, I think doesn't really enter my consciousness really.
Mm.
And I think it wouldn't. It would in circumstances, extreme national circumstances, then you would start feeling patriotic or even nationalistic if your country was invaded. Yeah. I mean, I suppose nationalism is the sort of patriotism that we disapprove of, or nationalism is patriotism in action, when it is shifted from a sort of rousing feeling in the bosom to let's go out and make things unpleasant for our neighbours.
It's the Marseillaise scene in Casablanca, and have the first to get the small hairs rising on the back of the neck. It's our hot button issue today. I hate to use that phrase, hot button issue, so I'll use it again. It's our hot button issue today, and it spins around this whole idea of nationhood. And on this head, our favourite thought puppy, John Sessions, shines a light on patriotism through the prism of our great novelist Charles Dickens, who carols once more at Christmas, this time with a former Prime Minister and a good literary doctor.
She could so easily have found occasion to retire to bed, but the urge to sustain the fires of exultation in her victory drove her on to even greater industry than was already her sedulous custom. The lamp still burned. Yet another phone call to Sir Terence Lewin reconfirmed the irreversible grip her forces held upon Port Stanley. These proceedings are closed. Oh, how she wished she could have said those words as Douglas MacArthur had in Tokyo Bay, indeed. But was she not drawn to heroic antecedents closer to home? A purposeful glare at the mirror confirmed that she was. The desk lamp illuminated the jacket of her suit in all its fetching naval blue. Her upper face was somewhat adumbrated, but one could not fail to note the striking similarity between her own pragmatic sweep of hair and that of the little admiral from Burnham Thorpe. Slowly, she closed one eye. With no less deliberation, she extricated her arm from one sleeve of her jacket and pinned the touchingly empty cloth upon her lapel, employing the brooch she usually wore with some reluctance. Above the dispatch boxes, as scarlet as the jacket of General Wolfe, she surveyed the picture thus presented. It was all colour and drama and heroism, worthy of pride of place in the Imperial War Museum. Yes, her spirit deserved no less. Her indefatigable, invincible spirit. How right her chosen adjectives should also be the names of mighty English warships, although both vessels, as she testily conceded, were blown up at Jutland. But was she not greater than Churchill? Yes, she was greater than Churchill. She clenched the only fist available for clenching and jutted her one-eyed features towards the mirror, allowing the light to burrow into all their vulpine spite. As she did so, she upset the lead crystal decanter, from which she had perhaps been partaking a touch too liberally. It crashed over, spilling not only over her victory speech, but upon at least a dozen other manifestos of heartfelt zeal. There had to be a means of saving such precious evidence for statesmanship. She lurched to the bookcase, tore open the elegant glass frames, and grabbed a dozen or so thick volumes from the shelves. These she opened, roughly in their middles, and applied to the sopping documents. Yes, the fibrous leaves swiftly absorbed the malty drops. As each book drank its fill of whiskey, she tossed the sodden ruins into the propinquitous waste receptacle. Then, a momentary twinge of intrigue made her hold two soaking spines up to the lamp. She squinted. A Christmas something. The something curiosity.
something. Well, she reflected, as she trod them down in the basket, as though labouring not for her country but in some far distant vineyard, little enough curiosity had been elicited from her. Novels existed purely to bring some illusion of occupation to the indolent. And what were such morbid tomes doing so close to her crucible of command? She would take them all to the boiler room straight away. She went to the door. As she did so, she heard footsteps ascending. Could it be her husband? The femininity, which never wholly slumbered within her, was awakened, and she fumbled in her reticule for a compact and other means of sly improvement to her physiognomy. She had just begun to apply a simple blush when the door burst open. A man of enormous girth, entangled in chains and manacles, stood before her. Rouge! He boomed with an awful profundity. Rouge! Oh, there's pretty for a head of state, madam. One might readily be persuaded that you were instead a trullish habitary of Vauxhall. Ah, oh, let me not excite my amorous propensities. And he moaned and shook his chains with fearful perturbation. Who are you? What are you, and what do you want? The lady was round the desk, unsteady but firm, if such a thing can be imagined. If you're a backbencher and these chains are evidence of sexual peccadilloes, you'd better see what they can do about averting scandal in the whip's office. I need no more office of whips, madam, returned the gentleman, on whose brow the ghostly sweat still managed to trickle as from a ham in August. My name is Dr. Samuel Johnson. In life, my fear of eternal torment compelled me to request the application of restraint, and yea, if I'm to speak plain, of the scourge. I entreated an estimable woman by the name of Thrale to belabour perfidy from me, and still my time in purgatory is but half elapsed. But I come here, madam, even as the honest drudge I was in life, to ask you this. How should one best preserve the integrity of this commonweal, eh? Should not the deep humanity of common law prevail? True, a woman at my urging took a stick to my body so that I might live hereafter. Is that not better, though, than a woman who takes a stick to her nation? And one who, having done so, perseveres to make that same people forget the sting of the switch by drawing them towards the equivocating nosegay of a seemingly righteous war. The lady was now sobered by the doctor's words. Her eyes flashed like a flintlock with the powder of conviction. Dr. Johnson, she calmly began, I know enough of you to know you backed King George's war against the American colonies to the hilt. I was wrong, madam, the doctor stoutly rejoined. Both purgatory and history have shown me that. An excessive staunchness towards my suffering stopped my ears against the dreadful organ note of unjust subjugation. You must remember, madam, that Parliament was in its infancy when the American Revolution occurred, and even then I stood steadfast against the bondage of the Negro. I even took one Francis Barber into my own household and paid thereafter for his intellectual betterment. I say this not out of wretched extenuation. I say it but to emphasize the savagery which now you exercise. A good 200 years of Parliament later, roll up your flags, give due honor to the fallen, and give these Falklands back to the Argentinian with whose terrain it is so rationally and righteously conjoined. For, madam, though I say it to a lady, patriotism is the last resort of a scoundrel. With this he bowed and turned, and with a fearful scraping of his manacles, made his ghostly way back down the stairs, passing, as he did so, those ministers who had held the sovereign seals from his time till now. As he reached the elder Pitt, he turned one final time. Madam, as I descend to resume my grim purification, I pass many a scoundrel and the odd Christian soul. I beg you may concern yourself with which category may pertain to you. Learn from patriotism past, address yourself to patriotism present, and thus preserve the nation from patriotism to... His peroration was roughly halted. She had already slammed the door.
Oh, John Sessions, when comes such another? Thank you very much indeed. Now, our musical guest today is something of a prodigy, too. He is World Party, whose terrific album, Bang, was only kept off the number one spot by R.E.M. He is, for us now, the man who put the wall in Carlinger, Carl Wallinger.
Glassless window, all that he could see was Babylon. Beautiful green fields and dreams, and learned to measure the stars. But there was a worry in his heart. He said, how did it come to this? I'm really worried. Like today, oh, wow. Then there came a day, it moved out across the Mediterranean, came to Western Isles and the Greek young men. And with the silver beards, they laughed at the unknown of the universe. They could just sit and guess God's name. But they said, how could it come to this? We're really worried about living. How could it come to this? Yeah, we really want to know about this. Where is it like today? There followed days of kings, empires, and revolution. Blood just looks the same when you open the veins. And sometimes it was faith, power, or reason as the cornerstone. But the furrowed brow has never left his face. He said, how could it come to this? We've been living in a landslide. How did it come to this? Yeah, I really want to know about this. What is it like today? Oh, well. Then there came a day, man backed up, flew up from the planet. He went to the moon, to the moon. And now he's out in space. Hey, he's fixing all the problems. He comes face to face with God, who says, how did it come to this? I'm really worried about my creation. How did it come to this? You're really killing me, you know. You're really killing me. What is it like today? Hey, wow. It isn't just a day. Hey, wow. Is it like today? Oh, bang! Ooh, ah, ooh. Many years ago, he looked out through a glassless window, didn't understand much what he saw.
much indeed.
Thank you.
Splendor. Splendor. Carl.
Strangest audience,
I must say. It must be rather odd to you, but it's like the rough anyway.
Strange people. Well, it's a strange collection.
Now, if you like books even a bit, there's a very strong chance that one of your favourite books of the last 5 years is Captain Corelli's Mandolin. If you like them a lot, there's a very strong chance that you possess the Latin American threesome, the War of Don Emmanuel's Nether Parts, Signor Viva and the Coca Lord, and the troublesome offspring of Cardinal Gutzmann. They're all by Louis de Bernier, whose name and the locus of whose works belies an upbringing as English as rice pudding. Born in London, raised in Surrey, trained at Sandhurst. With him to talk about issues of patriotism, duty and honour, Baroness Mary Warnock, an academic philosopher whose posts have included 17 years as fellow and tutor at St. Hugh's, Oxford, and then a period as mistress of Girton at Cambridge. She's best known perhaps for the Warnock Report on Human Fertilisation and Embryology, and for her work on that subject, which we as a race seem to be more in need of now than ever before, ethics. Her clarity and humility before the facts is a lesson to us all. She sits now as a crossbencher in the House of Peers. If I can turn to you then first, Mary Warnock, I believe it was Clemenceau who said that the difference between patriotism and nationalism was that a patriot loves his country, a nationalist hates everybody else's. Does that serve as a definition? Is nationalism wholly negative, do you think?
I think nationalism is wholly negative. I, speaking autobiographically, have not a drop of English blood in my veins. My mother was German on both sides, and my father was partly Scottish and partly Irish. So I think of myself as not having any English blood, but nevertheless extremely fond of England. And there are all kinds of things that I really love about England, like the landscape, particularly English cathedral music, things that are absolutely essentially English and don't belong anywhere else at all. And I think that I realised first that I was really patriotic, identified with England, in 1956, at the Suez Crisis, when I for the first time felt ashamed of my country. And you can't feel ashamed of something unless you identify with it. I mean, you can despise it or you can be cross with it or angry, but to be ashamed of it,
you must be emotionally implicated.
You must be emotionally involved. And again, I'm ashamed nowadays at the behaviour of English football hooligans. I mean, I don't like the way German hooligans behave, but it isn't shame. Mm. So I know that I am patriotic in the sense that I identify with England specifically. But I think that nationalism is always something which is directed against other countries. So in that sense, Clemenceau was absolutely right, I think.
Yes. And Louis de Bernier, you must be asked time and time again why you choose to set your novels away from your homeland. Your next is set in Turkey, I believe. Do you believe that, I think it's an old Victorian cry, what do they of England know who only England know? Do you think you often see your own country better from abroad?
Almost certainly. When I was 18, having made a fiasco of my short career in the army, I absconded to South America. And when I came back after about a year, I had a great deal of trouble ever feeling properly British again. And again, I'm not very keen on talking about Englishness, actually. I'm one of the few people I know who feels British.
Yes.
I have Scottish, Irish, Welsh, and distantly French blood. How can you possibly be? I don't believe there is any such thing as a pure-blooded Englishman or a pure-blooded Scot or et cetera, et cetera. It makes no sense to me at all.
No, and indeed, of course, the word blood is a sort of a silly...
It's a Hitlerian word, yes.
...or whatever it is, because it's, of course, with really genes, and they aren't English genes either. I mean, whatever the ethnology is, but we...
No, it's not as if you can't mate with the foreigner and not produce fertile offspring.
Exactly. One sense of nationhood is surely more cultural than anything to do with one's what blood means.
Yes. It must be cultural. I mean, and because of that, and because I suppose of having travelled a great deal and enjoyed a great many countries, I feel, as I said before, patriotic about several of them.
Yeah. And can one agree on qualities, do you think, Benia, that are specifically British, that stick with British, to ask you? I mean, every time I see the Great British something, I know it's a lie. They talk about the Great British breakfast, and it's exactly the same as the Great Dutch breakfast, frankly, except there isn't a smoked sausage or something.
No, not all of it's a cheese.
Yes, they do have cheese, perhaps. But do you know what I mean? All the Great British sense of humour is very often manifested as a complete lack of irony. We believe we have this immensely brilliant sense of irony, and it's often just sarcasm. You know, so many things that we claim to ourselves, other nations claim
to theirs. The French sense of irony is slightly more entertaining, I find.
Yes.
But the odd thing about all this Britishness or Englishness is that you can pick and choose as to what you think is British or English or whatever. The England that I love is that little bit of the, at the south of Surrey where I grew up. That's my England. I mean, when I'm in London, I don't feel I'm in England at all.
So it's really home one's talking
it's
about.
Home,
it's a universal human sense of home and what accretes to it are whatever values that one has about, which are as much perhaps to do with one's family as they are to do with the actual nature of this country.
Well, this, I think, is why patriotism is thought of as an amiable disposition, because it's a home-loving disposition, and as soon as one starts talking about nationalism, one's gone right beyond the borders of home into some universal concept of the nation, which is quite different.
It doesn't take long, does it, though, for one to start talking about oneself as a citizen of the world, for the Norman Tebbits and so on to start talking about sovereignty as some wielding it like a mallet over one's head.
But there's one terribly difficult thing, which is that patriotism used to be exemplified largely in war, and that entailed being war against another country. But now, if you join the army, you're not likely to be fighting another country, you're likely to be keeping the peace between two people of whom you may know nothing and are supposed to make no discrimination. And that, I think, does rather change the notion of patriotism. It's very difficult to think how soldiers fighting under the United Nations in their blue berets and whatnot actually are exhibiting patriotic virtues which were always associated with war. And people were proud that their sons laid down their life and it was honour and whatnot. Now,
the UN doesn't have the tunes, the marching songs.
Absolutely.
Now, I think I'm saying Bertrand Russell came in for a great deal of grief when he wrote against the First World War, and people said he was being deeply unpatriotic and so on, and he made, I suppose, what you might almost call a theological point, that his objection, he understood that young people were sent away to die for their country, but his real objection to the war is that young people were being sent away to kill for their country.
Yes.
And I see that as a much more patriotic point of view. You know, that is an awful thing to ask of your young, to kill. But still, people don't listen to that. They still believe somehow that there's a kind of circle of glory around activities to do with your country that you can't talk rationally
about.
Well,
the thing that's hard to understand is nowadays how you can go and cheerfully die for your country rather than for a good cause. For example, if we declared war on France to get Calais back, I would certainly not fight on the British side, and I might even be inclined to go and fight for the French. But if on the other hand, some just war came up, then I can see why one should go and fight for it. The idea of fighting for your country is somehow too abstract and too unjustified.
And are we now too...
You need a cause.
Are we now too sophisticated to believe, as, say, so many did at the beginning of the First World War, the kind of hurrahing and huzzahing that made people feel that was an immensely just war, which, looking back on it, to us, seems incredible to believe how... So keen people were to enlist, intelligent people.
But they couldn't see what it was at the time.
Yes.
I mean, we can look back on the... Sorry, this point has been made many times, but we look back on the 4 years of this gigantic industrialization of slaughter, whereas, in fact, most people believe that it would be 6 months if we build the Franco-Prussian War.
But do you think, Mary Warnock, that we could be sold a similar pup, as it were, that we could be whipped up into something that then... or are we now more sophisticated?
Sure. I think we probably are beyond that now, and I hope very much that we are. But what's amazing, I mean, I'm the only person here old enough to remember this, that although my generation were deeply cynical about the First World War and thought this was all inflated stuff, and we were sold, I mean, people before I was born, were sold this lie. When it came to the Second World War, reluctantly, we actually did agree that it was a just war. So I suspect that may be the last gasp of the concept of a just war.
Yeah.
Certainly not fought.
And do we believe...
Well, I don't actually... If I may interject a little bit about the Falklands.
Yeah.
So something that people keep forgetting about the Falklands is that it caused the downfall of the Argentine junta. The Argentine junta was not democratic. There was no democracy in Argentina. Those military people had invaded the Falklands with the explicit intention of getting the country behind them by exploiting nationalism.
I think the effect of that war was to
destroy that terrible unjust regime in Argentina. And I don't know why we ever congratulate ourselves for this.
But one of the things that caused great shame, really, to cynics who'd lived through the Second World War was the way that the then Prime Minister borrowed the expressions, borrowed the, and the press went on with it, borrowed the kind of chauvinist, awful language.
The full weight of Churchillian.
From the Second World War, that terrible occasion when Margaret Thatcher said, just rejoice. It absolutely.
It was rather a defining moment for many, was it not?
It was
yes, but Mary, you are a consequentialist. I mean, the consequence of that war was the liberation of Argentina.
But I'm not a consequentialist. But I don't. That's
not why we went to.
You're talking
war.
About what may be a good by blow from a bad act.
That's
right.
And I think it was the borrowing of what was the last, as I repeat, the last gasp of patriotism, and using that vocabulary that disgusted me and a lot of other people.
That was very manipulative. If she had said to the British public, actually, we want some of your young men to go and die in the Falklands so that democracy may be restored to Argentina, I don't think many people would have bought that line.
No.
Was that even that underlying intent. I'm sorry.
No,
it wasn't the underlying intent. Yeah. It was what the consequence was. Yes. The other thing was that, why do we sort of systematically forget that every single person on those islands wanted to remain British?
I'm glad to hear you say this, because I'm sure lots of people listening will think this too. I mean, I think most of us of our generation, I was just coming out of university, we happened, and we just thought it was all preposterous.
I agree that all the jingoism was preposterous, but I don't think the actual cause was.
But surely you're right, Stephen, that there could have been an argument for this war, but it wasn't presented.
Yes.
It was presented in terms that didn't belong to it.
I don't want to bury the conversation right into the Malvinas argument. And perhaps I can end with you, Mary Warren. Do you have faith in the English character as having any quality above what are basically human characteristics?
Well, what I rarely have faith in, but I'm afraid my faith may be being eroded, is in the British Constitution, actually, which makes the best of the British character. And
in the budget sense, the unwritten.
Absolutely. And I think that if people start to pay no regard to the virtues of the British Constitution, pay no regard to Parliament, for example, then we really may be in for a display of not very nice characteristics in the British people.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that, because much to the dismay of some of my friends, I'm entirely with you on that. And I've always been attacked for not joining up to these brand new constitution charters this and charters that, and I don't quite know in myself whether it's sentimentality or reason, but then that's the very subject of patriotism, some weird blend of sentimentality and reason. And perhaps to bring us all to our senses now, Carl Wallinger will sing for us again. It may clear up all these problems. It's called, this song, not unintriguingly, "You're a Hurricane, I'm a Caravan."
Don't own me,
a very modest song from Mark Wallinger.
The roofing tile.
Carol Wallinger, I called you Mark. I'm so sorry. Now, I think Cecil Rhodes said that to have been born English was to have drawn first prize in the lottery of life. And I remember my esteemed friend and colleague Hugh Laurie, whose father rode in the British Olympics in Berlin in the 1930s, when, of course, Hitler was the Führer. And they were kept up all night before the finals against Germany, the rowing eight. And there was a dinner afterwards. You'd be glad to know that England won, despite having been kept up all night by motorbikes going around their room.
Won the dinner.
And the leader of the German eight made a toast to the British, congratulating them on their victory, and saying, "I think I speak for all the boat crew, and I say that if we had not been born German, then we would like to have been born English." And the English stroke or captain of the boat got up and said, "I think I speak for our entire boat if I say that if we had not been born English, we'd rather not have been born at all. Thank you very much." And I wondered if I can play this silly game and go around the table and ask if you weren't born English or British, which nationality would you like to be born, Julian?
Oh, I'd go for French.
You amazed me.
That's extraordinary. Banal, yes. But I probably live on the Channel Islands, or the Ile Anglo-Normande, as I prefer to call them.
Excellent. And what about you, Louis?
Well, it depends what I want from life. I mean, if I wanted absolutely crazy optimism, I'd choose to be Brazilian. But I'd rather agree with Julian. I'd rather be French. When all my contemporaries were growing up wanting to be Americans, I wanted to be French.
It's a French surname. I mean, are you Huguenot?
Yes, that's the family was from Normandy.
All right. And what about you, John?
Same as Julian and Louis.
French all round so far. Yeah. Mary Warnock, are you going to...
Not French. I'd rather be Czech. I think I'd have around me the most marvellous architecture in Prague, and I'd have this deep sense of local music, music that belonged in Czechoslovakia. And I have a very great admiration for the Czech, and lots of Czech friends. I'd love to be
a
Czech.
A friend of mine recently came back from Prague and said there are five museums, three opera houses, one of which saw the first production of Don Giovanni, four cathedrals, the most amazing
brilliant
bridges,
marvelous,
and one McDonald's. And he said to me, "Guess which one had a quarter-mile queue outside it." It was rather depressing. And Carl?
Well, I've got this band, and it's called World Party, so, you know, choosing another country, apart from being English, it just seems... I just like to be on the planet.
Choose Galania.
I'd like to wake up and all countries have just disappeared and we wouldn't have to have conversations like this.
Myself, I have a strange yearning to be Pomeranian. I don't know why. But well, time has been and gone and done and been and done it and gone it and done it and been it again. Now fades the glimmering landscape on the site and all the air a solemn stillness holds. I remark the chalk face of Dover in my spyglass. The sheep are on the lee, a golden light suffuses the elm and oak of England, home and beauty. England, my England. Home is the hunter, home from the hill, and the sailor, home from the sea. Oh, to be in England now that England's here. They told me, Heraclitus, they told me you were dead. They brought me bitter news to hear and bitter tears to shed. Evening in the bowl of night has taken the stone that puts the stars to flight. Bring me my robe, put on my crown, I have immortal longings in me. The high-tog duvet of evening enfolds our naked, supple forms, and we are for the night. It is farewell from Louis de Bernier, Carl Wallinger, Baroness Warnock, Julian Barnes, John, Stop It At One Sessions, and from me, Stephen Fry. Until we meet again, citizens of the world, subjects of the Queen, and objects of affection, Godspeed.